From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Today we're featuring interviews from our archive, interviews which elicited a great deal of listener response. Have you ever wondered how the products we buy get their names? Ira Bachrach is president of NameLab. From soft drinks to cars, Ira has been involved in the creation of many product names familiar to us all. We discuss the meaning of names, as well as the international trends in naming products and companies. We'll also talk with Evelyn Brown, president of Swan Publishing. Evelyn has written several romance novels, but hers have a twist. She uses her computer to personalize stories just for you. We'll talk about just how she does it. Not long ago, I visited a classic auto museum in the Bay Area. It was there that I became curious about how cars get named. Ira Bachrach is in the product naming business. He's responsible for naming some of today's better-known automobiles, including the Acura and Geo. I asked him how the names of cars have evolved over the years.
Well, there are all sorts of interesting stories. Jaguar is a very well-known brand these days. Jaguar was originally the Swallow Sidecar Company. They made sidecars for motorcycles. And in about 1935, they brought out a car, and they named it the SS for Swallow Sidecar. And then later on, they brought out a sports car, and they named it the SS Jaguar. Jaguar being, a fast, muscular animal and appropriate for sports cars. Interestingly, however, during World War II, the name SS became rather unhandy for a British manufacturer, and so they dropped the original heritage name of the car and the company and simply went to Jaguar. There are a variety of stories like that that are interesting to us. We name cars and have named them for several American and Japanese manufacturers, and just from gossip, you learn a variety of interesting stories. For example, Mercedes stemmed from Daimler, and what happened was Daimler made very successful race cars, and one of the great race drivers of the time was named Emil Jelinek. What the time is the beginning of the century, 1899, 1900. And he ran a race in France in a Daimler car. And for a variety of reasons, one hears a number of stories having to do with betting, but I'm not sure which are true, he decided to run under a pseudonym. And so instead of running under his well-known name, Emil Jelinek, he called himself Herr Mercedes, after his daughter, whose first name was Mercedes. And he won the race. After winning the race, he commissioned Daimler to build him a series of similar cars, which he sold as their representative in Europe and the United States under the name Mercedes. And when Daimler merged with Benz, one of the very first car companies a few years later, they changed the model name to Mercedes-Benz. And so that's how
So it was really his daughter's name.
It was his daughter's name, and it was a pseudonym, and he just happened to win the race. In those days, there were many entries, the cars were unreliable, and the probability of any one fellow, even a famous fellow, winning a single race was relatively small. And so he was somewhat embarrassed having won the race under an assumed name. I guess if he thought he was going to win it, he would have run it under his own name.
Lent sort of an untrustworthy air to that Mercedes, which has spent all these years building up that trust, you know.
Yeah, I guess it does.
Just a bad start to a good idea.
Other interesting thing, Cadillac, premium American make, the top of the General Motors line, is a French name. It was named after a fellow named Antoine de la Mothe, who was the founder of Detroit, which was originally a trading post, you know. And he was out there in the boonies, you know, basically trading for skins with the Indians, and he decided to make himself seem more noble, and so he adopted the what seemed like a title, Sieur, S-I-E-U-R, which means son, of Cadillac. Cadillac was a region in France, and this was a self-knighting, certainly, but de la Mothe was rather complicated to say. Cadillac was easier to say for people whose native language was English, and So he got to be known as Cadillac, and the car was named after him as an historical reference.
Another false name.
Yeah, well, the cars are full of such things. we were talking before we went on the air. You ran across a car named Firebomb?
Yes. Yes, that was a the Fire Arrow, which was made by Dodge, and it's a fabulous sports car, you know, and the Eddie Fisher and all, you know, the big names, all the movie stars and popular people had them, and they made a special model of the Fire Arrow convertible called the Firebomb, and of course, all the listing of the people who owned it seemed to be men.
Yeah, well, and it must have been in the 40s or 50s, and one could imagine the social reaction to such a model name these days.
Well, that's true. You know, but that's a very good question. Several feminist types have registered a distinct dislike for the name of that new car, the Probe.
And the funny thing is the Probe, which is for those of you who might be unfamiliar with it, it's a personal luxury car made by Ford, or made by Ford and Mazda together, is sold largely to women, and it was meant to be sold, I think, largely to women, and they test names. We make names for most of the current car manufacturers, and they don't take our word for it. They go out and test them. And when they tested the name, I assume that they got this, that's a rather aggressive male name, from women who were an important part of the intended customer base. But people have found out through the years that you can't package a car for a woman, paint it pink, and name it Missy. Women want cars which historically fit their sense of what automobiles are about. And so if they wanted a personal luxury car which suggested sportiness, the name Probe, while it turned a fair number of folks off, also suggested to them that it was a genuine sports car or sporty car rather than something that was kind of put together with ruffles for women.
Oh, so they don't like it, but
they don't like it, but they like it. Yeah,
well, you know, it's an interesting thing because there's a tremendous PR effort because the leader of the design team for the first time is a woman, and she wanted to make sure those female needs were addressed, and she actually made her male engineers, here's the kinky part, wear fake nails, fake fingernails, and turn the, you know, radio on and off and adjust the seat and try to, you know, can you imagine the meeting with the announcement?
Yeah, well, having spent a fair amount of time in the model development areas of the Detroit manufacturers, I can't imagine that going on, you know.
Well, I think they had the doors locked that day. There are no pictures, too. But I think that was pretty interesting. Let me get back for a few more times to these automobiles, the old ones. They seem to be mostly names of the man, you know, sort of first names or surnames.
Eponymy. They're named after the manufacturer, after the fellow who started the company. That's the classic pattern with automobiles. It is, in fact, a classic pattern with most company names as well. We think of companies as sort of being around forever, but the idea of a corporation is a relatively modern idea. And in America, I guess, I think the first brand name, company name per se, was Revere Silver, which was the Paul Revere who named it after himself. And the reason people tended to name, when they adopted names for companies rather than just being the fellow who made horseshoes down the street, named things after themselves, was to suggest that they are responsible so that if your candy dish was crooked, you could go find Paul and say, gee, Paul, you know, this is terrible. You ought to fix it. And for a long time, that was the dominant pattern. And then when communications got better and companies would function, would make goods or provide services in more than one city, the next wave of companies were named regionally. You would call yourself Boston Silver if you made, you know, candy dishes. But eponymy was the original model for corporate and brand identity and still is a dominant model. And then they went to geographic identity. And then in the great agglomeration period where things like U.S. Steel were born, you adopted a name which suggested what you did and suggested it in a way which implied that you owned that industry. And names like U.S. Steel and American Bridge and Iron and such were adopted.
When we're talking about naming technology, that's a fairly new game because there hasn't been a lot of technology, right?
Well, the name companies are relatively new. We were among the first, if not the first, and we were founded. I started the company in 1980. Before that, most names were made. In fact, those names still are made by the companies who make the products or offer the services or their advertising agencies, and it's done creatively. Many name companies are small firms where the process is still done creatively. Bright, verbal people sit around, and someone says, "Eureka, let's call it Jell-O."
But it's a car.
We do it. Well, yeah. Let's call it Jell-O Probe. But we do it somewhat more analytically and somewhat more technologically. NameLab's method is based on a table of what are called morphemes, M-O-R-P-H-E-M-E, that is. In linguist jargon, a morpheme is a word-forming element. It's the least smallest meaningful element in a word, like the van in advantage, which means front of or top of or leading edge of. And this derives from my graduate thesis many years ago. I'm an electrical engineer who did a year of a doctorate in linguistics and never finished it. And what I developed was a notational system for these morphemes. And after founding and selling a few companies, mostly technological firms, and retiring young, my wife suggested I should go back to work, you know, stop hanging around and complaining. And so I dusted off my graduate thesis and founded NameLab. And the way I did it was I had compiled a table of morphemes, which we tried to make complete, every morpheme in American English, using this notational system, which was my graduate thesis. And so we negotiate with a client a set of messages to be expressed in the name, like small integral object, which is a computer, was a message set that we got from a company called Gateway Technology. And we extract from our table every morpheme that bears in any way upon each of the messages the client's after, and then we combine them to make every word that would be possible in English expressing those ideas. And for small integral object, which is a computer, we made the name Compaq, C-O-M-P-A-Q. And the it ends in Q rather than C or K because we were trying to make a word which would be visible and memorable when you saw it in the typeset columns of the Wall Street Journal. That was the client's instruction.
Oh.
The client was a small company, and there was a financial fellow, Ben Rosen, behind it. And he thought that the primary marketing problem would be whether anyone would at that time buy an IBM-compatible computer from anybody smaller than IBM. At the time Compaq was founded, RCA and GE had recently gone out of the computer business. And he thought that the dominant forum in which you knew how big a company was magazines and newspapers, primarily things like the Wall Street Journal. And the more often you remembered seeing the word in the Wall Street Journal, the larger you'd think the company would be. With a Q on the end of the word, since no other words you're likely to see in that day's issue of the journal will end in Q, your brain has to go through an extra step to convert the word from notation letters to sound. Remember, you think in sound. You don't think in the alphabet. Because you learn to speak 5 years before you learn to read. And forever after, when you read things, you convert them as you read them to sounds, and then your brain operates on those sounds to determine what the words are. Since a terminal Q was a novel element, your brain would stop for a second and go, huh, and convert the Q to a phonetic K. Okay. We thought that extra step would make the word more memorable. That's why Compaq ends in a Q.
Well, you know, what you're saying is it just strikes me instantly as you say it. You know, and you're always trying to get a little this and a little that. Yeah. And
we
you're right.
Didn't invent any of these insights. We use a lot of linguistic
tricks.
Insights and tricks. Tricks. We prefer insights, but tricks
we
in our work.
Tricks.
But we didn't invent any of them. They come out of linguistics textbooks. There's been a great deal of study of how language works, particularly over the past 20 years, having to do with language disadvantaged children. Brain-damaged children or children for one reason or other have trouble comprehending language. So there's been a great deal of study about what makes words memorable, easy to comprehend, easy to say. that very same set of rules applies to a good brand name. You want it to be memorable, comprehensible, easy to say. And we have just abstracted that from the literature of linguistics, educational linguistics, and resold it to large corporations.
Now, when you're making a name, let's go back. Was it Acura?
Yes, we made Acura.
You're making up new words.
Usually, but not always. What we do is we make every word that's possible in English based on the morphemes which seem appropriate. The largest repository of English nouns, that English, by the way, is the largest language in the world. There are more words and more nouns in English than any other language by far, which is one reason it's becoming the world language. But the largest repository of English words that I know of is the OED, or the Oxford English Dictionary, and it has 400,000-odd words in it. As there are, by our notational method anyway, something more than 6,000 morphemes, and words are combinations of one, two, or occasionally three of these, plus artifacts of pronunciation and grammar, there are millions of possible words. When you make every possible word based on a set of ideas, 9 out of 10 of them will be new words, which is sort of handy these days when you're trying to make brand names, because most appropriate natural nouns, like complete if you're making a toothpaste, have been taken, and you can't get decent legal rights in them. But we do occasionally derive from the original morpheme a natural word which is appropriate, which will work. Most of our words, however, are new words.
Are new. My guest today is Ira Bachrach. He is president of NameLab. Tell us about Acura. How did you get to Acura?
That was an interesting problem. Honda was at that time a very well-regarded, still is a very well-regarded make. The problem was that Hondas up to that point were economical cars. They were small economical cars. And there was great concern as to whether the American public would cotton to the idea of a Japanese luxury car. Remember, Acura was the first one. In consulting on this problem, one of the thoughts we had was that if the word had no significant meaning which helped define it as a luxury car, the first thing you'd think of was, gee, it's a jumped-up Honda, which wouldn't mean they couldn't sell the car, but would mean that they probably wouldn't be able to get the price premium normally accorded to genuine luxury cars which have a socially upscale position. The input statement we agreed on was luxury car with high engineering content. For that came from the client. We asked them what made this car different from other luxury cars, and they said, well, it's rather like a BMW in concept, but it's more modern. And as I remember, I said, well, what do you mean like a BMW? And I said, well, there's a higher percentage of the money that you spend for the car goes for engineering than it might in another make. And so we ended up with luxury car with high engineering content. We took the word engineering apart into component elements like geometry and science and whatever, and one of the elements was precision. We made names out of all of the morphemes which bore upon those elements, and the best name we made was Acura, which is built on the morpheme acu. Acu means precisely or with care in a mechanical sense in most Western languages. That stems from acurare in Latin.
Now let me ask you what you think of this car name, Edsel.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. Edsel, of course, is a rather ugly word.
Appropriately so, as I recall.
Well, they didn't think the car was ugly at the time. The interesting story behind it, however, is that Ford, this was the magnum opus of the product development team. They wanted the perfect name for it. And they went through thousands of solutions from the ad agency, from employees, and whatever. And a fellow named David Wallace, who I think was VP PR of the Ford division at the time, hired Marion Moore, great poet, to help in the development of the name of this car. And Miss Moore was rather diffident. You know, poets are not normally employed in such crass commercial endeavors. But they eventually persuaded her to forfeit to come up with names for this automobile. And they knew they were in trouble. The car was a great secret at the time, and they knew they were in trouble because they sent her color renderings of the cars, and she wrote back to Mr. Wallace a very an elegant letter in which, among other things, she said that when she saw the sketches of the car, if you hold them upside down, they look like brightly colored tropical fish. And he thought, well, gee. actually, she suggested a number of names. The one that she most strongly supported was Ford Silver Sword. Silver Sword is a plant that grows in the Sierras. And her idea was Ford Silver Sword was rather like a poem. It probably would have been a better name than Edsel. Interestingly, some of the other names that she suggested that they rejected, more or less out of hand, ended up being, through no connection to Miss Moore, very important car names 20 or 30 years hence. Her sense of language was so good, she was way ahead of the Ford folks. She, for example, suggested Civic.
Oh, she did?
Yes.
A poetess suggested Civic.
And the car name, and they said, Civic, well, you know. Well, you know, it was the poet, and she suggested Diamante, which is a Mitsubishi name.
That's right.
She suggested Chaparral, which ended up being the name of a race car and eventually a Ford sports model. She also, however, suggested very strongly Intelligent Bullet, which I guess firebomb worker.
Yeah. You don't think they were sending her checks and she just like tossed out six names and
no, she was very serious about it. She was, again, poets are rarely employed, and to someone who is rarely employed in commercial endeavor, being employed in commercial endeavor is quite exciting. you know, and we at NameLab have occasionally thought well, perhaps we would hire a poet, since our method is so mechanical. We'd to add a romantic view of language. But we've never run across a poet that, you know, fits with us linguistic computer types.
That's right. Now, do you get involved as well in the numbering of, say, technology models too?
Yes, we have made. Well, those are called trim level descriptors. That's what they originally called. Now they're called model numbers. We have made systems for a variety of manufacturers. It is a more complex and interesting process than you might think.
I'll tell you the reason I asked this is that I remember when Intel came out with its first 8088 chip, and the last 8 stood for the number of bits from the memory up to the CPU, up to the processor. Mm-hmm. And so everybody says, oh, who cares? That's fine, 8088. And then the path, if you will, from the memory up to the processor doubled to 16 bits. Mm-hmm. And so you could get it up pretty much twice as fast. This was a real improvement. And so they said, well, since the engineer says it's the last
8086.
Bit, it's not 8, it's 16, so we'll make the last bit a 6. And so I remember standing there the day I heard it, that the 8088 is slower than a lower number, 8086. And I said, they didn't ask the naming boys in mass marketing that day. Faster is a lower number, you know.
That's an interesting story.
So tell me about the numbers. Tell me your perspective.
Most of the numbers systems we've made have been for automobile models. We actually consulted with Intel recently, and normally our work is confidential. The only reason I can say that is they sent out a news release.
They didn't pay you. None of that.
Oh, no,
lie.
They did. No, they having to do with the transition from the 386, 486, 286 series to the new name Pentium. Pentium is not our name. It's made by another name company, as a matter of fact. What we did was consulting on how to do it and the strategic issues involved. We haven't, in the context that you're assuming, we haven't really made any numbering systems. We've made them for cars. The reason we did one for DuPont, but the reason we haven't is that the perceiver in such environments is nearly always an intellectually making an intellectually considered decision. An engineer who's buying a part is not driven by the brand name or anything fancy. He reads the specs. He reads EBG or EEM and makes a decision on that basis. And so the numbering systems, the best they can be is understandable, comprehensible, so that you know that a 16 is larger than an 8. And the numbering systems are usually made by engineers. The model names are, in fact, part numbers, and they're made as logically as they can, and there's no need for people like us.
So the numbers really aren't selling points, although I have to understand that.
The specs are.
That the specs are.
Yeah. Intel got itself into an odd position, and the problem that Intel was having was that there were companies, one called Cyrix and another, who were bringing out products and calling them 486s, and they weren't. There were other architectures which had some of the characteristics of a 486. Intel's problem was that they were afraid that this beautiful world standard that they had created would be shattered when people bought computers which said 486 on the outside, and they had a chip on the inside that wouldn't run all the software. And a good deal of the magic of the microcomputer business is based on Intel's ability to have created a single world standard for one of the two major world standards for microprocessors. Of course, the Motorola systems in Apple's are the other, and there's a third, which they call AX in Japan, which is largely NECs. But Intel is certainly the dominant one in the world. If the names had started to be used imprecisely, there was a chance that that standard would be ruined. So it was a much bigger issue than, gee, these guys are going to sell something and we'll lose a few sales.
Huge. Yeah. You can completely destroy a market that way.
Well, it would have caused significant damage, and the assumption that if I buy it and it says something 86 on it, it will run whatever software is DOS compatible, is worth billions of dollars, not only to Intel, more importantly to its customers.
Right.
You see? And so that was the reason that they had to go through the process and adopt a new name. The new name they adopted was Pentium, which suggests fifth generation is a rather nice word. Actually.
Now, you're talking about English phenoms. Does this have a good, a bad, and anything effect, if you will, when these products go out to France and South America and Asia?
Well, technological products, the answer is quite straightforward. English is the world language of technology. Therefore, even if a German manufacturer brings out a product that he wants to sell in just throughout Europe, he's very likely to adopt an English name for it, because English has become the de facto language of technology. In fact, English is becoming the de facto language of the world, not because of any intellectual or moral superiority of English speakers, but it's the most powerful language on the face of the earth. If you think about it, we have more morphemes, more word-forming elements than anyone else, and the fewest rules for making new nouns. If you are in French, for example, you need to worry about masculine or feminine, and a variety of other issues in constructing a noun. In English, the only forms or tenses of nouns that exist is basically the plural and the possessive, which is just an S on the end of the word. So you can, without restriction, make new words out of these many meaningful elements. Hence, new things like lasers and such tend to be named with English words. If you had to name them with German words, the word would, German is an agglutinative language, and the word might be eight syllables long. Therefore, English is becoming the world language of technology. More importantly, English is becoming the world language of civilization. I recently read that something more than half of all adults under 35 in Western Europe, defined as Austria going west, now speak English as a first or second language. And it's widely known among linguists that English is by far the dominant second language, a language everybody studies. If you want to fly an airplane or even read a great body of literature other than your own, which might be in Devanagari or something, the first language you study is English. Because it is becoming the common language that people have other than their native language, it's becoming the world language. This is quite important for English manufacturers. Manufacturers in countries whose native language is English, since it's easier for them to form brand names, and it's vitally, critically, brilliantly important for software writers, software manufacturers, since a good part of the reality of what lives inside software is language.
Ira Bachrach is president of NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. He also happens to be responsible for creating the name of this program. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Evelyn Brown is a romance novel writer. In her career, Evelyn has written only 3 novels, and yet she has published hundreds. How can that be? I asked Evelyn how her novels are different.
Oh, well, I take your name and your sweetheart's name and put them into my novels, so it comes out to be a 100-page hardbound romance novel featuring the two of you.
As an aficionado of the genre, what are the elements or the characteristics of a romance novel?
Well, of course, there's that old formula of boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back.
Ah.
There's exotic locations. Mm-hmm. There's the guarantee of a happy ending. He will always get her back, and they will always walk off into the sunset.
And that's true of all the romance novels.
It's absolutely true. I've read one in the last 10 years where that didn't happen, and I was furious. That's one of the things that you know, no matter how bad your day has been, you can climb into bed or climb into a bubble bath and end up having this wonderful fantasy.
Happy ending. Now, I have to say, in reading some of the samples that you were I saw, there's sort of a style or verbiage that one associates with romance novels.
Romance novels are very sensuous, and I don't mean that just skin to skin, but you learn to write a romance novel using all 5 senses. You don't just walk into a room. You walk into the room, and you notice the wall coverings, and you notice what cologne the man that just left the room was wearing, and you notice, you know, the temperature of the room if it's too hot, and you know, and those things all change according to what's going on between the hero and heroine.
Oh, so, well, that's very interesting. That's not true of a typical novel, is it?
I imagine there's elements of that, but that's something that in romance writer's school, that's definitely, you know, you say, you know, whenever the heroine turns around, you know, you may not write them all down, but you, as the writer, sense everything she's sensing and report on the most important things.
Now, would you say that the female is the main character, or the male, or both of them?
Well, most often, it's definitely the female that's the main character. However, I like to write, and I read more and more in the romance novels, of having them written from the male point of view. At least a chapter, a scene, a couple of things, so that you know he's really turned on by her. And you already know she's turned on by him. But even though their actions towards each other may not reflect that, you know that they are both turned on. So that's the important thing.
To establish that. Yeah, it is kind of one-sided if you're not sure what the other person's doing.
Right, but there's usually early on, there's a scene that's written from the male point of view that lets you know his reactions are true, and he's willing to fall in love with her if she's willing to fall in love with him, and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I remember reading some little snippet that said, like, I felt him before I saw him, or something, you know, one of these things. Well, how did you learn to write romance? Is there really a romance writer school, or did you just pay attention?
Oh, there's lots of them. There's lots of ways. One of the things I did is I picked up Catherine Falk's book, who is a very well-known romance lecturer. She writes, edits the Romance Writers magazine. And that goes through step by step what your heroine should be like, what your hero should be like, what your setting should be like, and how the pacing should go throughout the novel. And of course, it's suggestions, and there's variations on it, and that's what makes everything interesting. And then I took a couple of classes, you know, through Romance Writers of America, through my local college, and I read a whole lot of romance novels myself.
Really? So you have a full library.
Right, right.
When you personalize these, you use a computer.
Right.
How did you come upon that sort of scenario of why don't we do a romance novel and personalize
it? Well, the company I had been working for was sold, and I was looking for new employment. And my husband said, why don't you write romance novels? You're always reading those things. And so
those
I said,
things.
Gee, you know, you write them, you send them away, they reject them. I said, I don't think I could take that kind of abuse, you know. And so he said, well, how about if you personalize them and put the couple's names in them? And I said, that's it. And I was up for the rest of the night because we had been laying in bed at the time. So that got me started, and it supports my computer habit.
That's great. Now, before we talk about the computer end of this, let's talk about all the variations on the theme that you have.
Okay.
First of all, you've got three different novels.
Right. There's one set in California, one set in Hawaii, and one set around a winning lottery ticket.
Okay. So the first thing you choose is which one of those.
Mm-hmm.
You want, where you, how you see yourself,
yes.
Whether you're sort of on a Hawaiian vacation.
Right. Well, the California one is very romance-oriented, you know. It's in its purest sense. Then the California mm-hmm. one has a lot of adventure. They go hiking through the jungles of Kauai and
oh, the Hawaiian
yeah.
one.
And then the lottery one is set around a winning lottery ticket. And, of course, they lose the ticket after it wins. And so it's a lot of kind of madcap running around the town trying to figure out where the ticket could be. They go through all the trash. They, you know, accuse each other's friends. It's lots of fun.
So they actually are fun to read.
They're a blast to read. And especially personalized because suddenly your husband or your sweetheart or your wife or your sweetheart is put into these situations and it's interesting to see the reactions and you know, I've done them for family members and things like that as doing proofreading. And, you know, oh, this person would never react that way, but this one's dead on, you know. And so they're fun to write because you try to write in a lot of different situations so that there's always going to be that time when you go, wow, that really is exactly what she'd do. So it's fun to write those.
Now, this actually gets pretty complicated. I mean, I'm just saying ballpark figures here. The minimum that you get, the keepsake edition, which is mm-hmm. in the $50 price range.
Right.
What do you get for that?
You get your name and your sweetheart's name as the hero and heroine throughout the book. Each book is custom run. And you can write your own dedication where you can express your love in your own words. It's hardbound, runs just about 100 pages.
And then you can bump up from there.
Right,
around
for an additional $70. $20,
uh-huh.
You get hair and eye color, nicknames, hobbies, friends' names, special song, favorite flowers, your pet's name, your favorite dinner together. You can describe your first kiss. And you can even choose your sensuality level between our G-rated Candlelit Edition and our PG-rated Burning Embers Edition.
Now, what's the difference between Candlelit and Burning Embers?
Oh, well, the love scenes are extended, of course. A little bit more detail, a little bit more excitement, and a little bit more heat.
A little more heat. Huh? Well, what's the hottest level that we can talk about on radio?
I call it PG+. Would you like to hear a little bit of it?
Yeah.
Can you give me two names to stick in there?
Hillary and Bill.
I love it. Okay. His kiss lingered on her lips. Hillary's eyes fluttered as Bill rained kisses featherlight along her throat. Her flimsy sarong did not hinder his exploration.
Holy moly.
Oh, you're making me giggle. Hillary's skin was ablaze as the curve of his hand met the curve of her. Well, you have to read the book to find out.
Yeah, to find out. Now, is that sort of typical romance novel jargon?
Oh, yes.
It's not, we're not talking physiological descriptions here. We're talking, how would I say?
Well, lingered, fluttered, feather light.
Ah.
That's very romance, soft kind of wording.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, from that, from those meager beginnings, you can jump up to the $200 PS edition.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is that?
PS edition includes a custom-written epilogue that's based solely upon your romance. They usually run 15 to 20 pages. And I have a questionnaire that asks about 50 or 60 questions covering everything from your first date when you fell in love, your wedding, your children, your house, whatever you want to tell me about your life together, your most romantic vacations, anything like that. And now I have a new Jubilee edition that runs $295, and it adds a little more detail to that epilogue, going back to your early life and your memories of your parents and grandparents, your schooling, and the events that led you to meet your sweetheart. And so it becomes a complete romantic biography.
Well, you know, I'm really struck by the difference between, let's just write a whole lot of text and substitute the hero's name and the heroine's name to an enormous number of details.
Right. Well, I go from putting your names into my story to writing your complete story. Mm. And that's what keeps it interesting is I did a Jubilee edition for a couple that have been married 50 years.
Ooh.
And I mean, it was this, the fella contacted me and said, we're having a 50th anniversary party in about 3 months, and I want to do this. And he sat down and wrote all this, I mean, how anybody can even remember it, much less after 50 years, about their courtship in the 30s. It was just amazing. I mean, about him coming to class at whatever college in a raccoon coat. I mean, all that stuff that you kind of hear about and think, oh, they're making it up. And this is how these people courted. It was just amazing.
What kind of a computer system do you use?
I use an IBM PC clone. I'm up to a 386 machine. I've got three 386s and three laser printers running. And I have a laptop that I do my writing on. And I have a dot matrix that I do my labels on. And
you have a complete computer lab here.
Yeah. Well, as I say, it supports my computer habit with mice and scanners and, you know, the teachers always know when mom's helped with the homework because suddenly, you know, pictures on the report and all this stuff.
The professional look.
Yeah.
So you've got three computer systems and three laser printers. So is that one laser printer for each computer system?
Yes.
And then your laptop is your sort of traveling, composing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can go sit at the breakfast table and work on the epilogues while the computers are running out in the garage.
Oh, so these are all in your garage.
Yeah, it's a converted office in the garage.
Do you just use a word processor, or do you have a special program?
Oh, you know, I used to say, oh, I have a custom-written personalization program, but yeah, I just use WordStar and a mailing list. I mean, it's pretty funny when you see, you know, somebody will come and say, here, you know, my husband will say, let me help you with that, and it's like, okay, well, see where it says company name? That's the hero's last name. And the first line of address is his eye color, and it just gets
a little too much.
I have it memorized, but I don't think anybody else could do it.
There you go. Yeah, I was thinking, well, gee, maybe she could sell this business, but I'm not sure it's easily transferable.
No, it would be pretty weird. I keep thinking about I need to get some kind of a grid that I paste over the screen, you know. Then you'd have to rip it off when you want to write, or it'd be ridiculous. Yeah. So
it'd be too much. Is one novel in one word processing file, or is it like a series of chapters?
Oh, no, I can run any of the novels on any of the machines. And you know how it is when you have a small business. You know, they're in varying states of repair. And, you know, I have a real good laser printer and a real good second. And the third, actually, those two are duplex. Uh-huh. So I can run books on those. And then the third one is for my front pages and my dedications and my sales material. And that's just a single-page laser printer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's a smaller laser printer.
It's just a 2 instead of a 2D.
Now, you did say you scan photographs and pictures?
Yes, I can scan the couple's picture and bind it right into the book. And I also have a program called Special Days that allows me to do kind of a This Day in History time script that tells me all about the day you were married or whatever, and then I can bind that right into the book as well.
Oh, so you know that when you put on your wedding elements, you know that you walked outside and saw that Ronald Reagan was about to be inaugurated.
Right.
Something like that. It looks like you have multiple versions of the novels because you have more and more detail. Mm-hmm. For each level of the novel, do you have different novels? I mean, different sort of situations?
Well, no, because if someone buys my keepsake edition, so I don't know their hair and eye color, mm-hmm. She suddenly has luxurious hair, you know, and it doesn't say whether it's blonde or brunette or redhead.
Uh-huh.
So it becomes a little bit less specific, but it's the same version of the novel. Now, I do have different versions of the novel. One of the things I offer is you can set the story at Christmas time. So I have a Christmas setting for all three of the novels that has just a little bit different text in it. Then I have a set of novels that all have Junior after the man's name. If it's so-and-so, Junior. And I also have a set of novels that's Dr. So-and-so, so that, you know, you fit all these different situations.
So if somebody's a doctor, mm-hmm. you must have a lot of disk space.
Yeah, I wish I had more, but don't we all?
Don't we all?
It just, you know, and then, you know, I have Ventura on one, and I have the Special Days on it. You kind of, okay, well, I can put this one on this disk, but it's too small to take this program, so I'll put that over here, and you just keep moving them around.
Well, my guest today is Evelyn Brown, and she is a romance novel author who personalizes the romance novel for you. How do you actually get the names in the books? Is it, I mean, most of us have used word processing packages. Do you just have a particular word and you just substitute on that word?
It's a mail merge.
Oh, so you're merging mm-hmm. the little symbols.
Yeah, when I first started, I thought, oh, you know, you'll never be able to merge something 100 times throughout the whole novel to get the heroine's name. But yeah, it doesn't, you know, they don't care how many times you put those little symbols in. Every time it hits those symbols in the document, it just replaces it. So
you're using a standard word processing mm-hmm. thing. And for people who don't know what a mail merge is the standard vanilla application for a mail merge is, let's say I have a standard letter. I have a vendor listing. I'm a company, and I buy things from 300 different other companies. And I have a dear vendor letter to go out. Mm-hmm. And what I do is I put a little symbol in there for it works a variation of these themes, but I put a little symbol in there saying dear quote vendor, and then I have a whole other database that has all my vendors, the names, the addresses, the zip codes, and all of that. And so you can keep printing that out, merging each vendor into their own specific letter. And you've seen this kind of application.
It's our regular junk mail.
Yeah, dear Moira Gunn, you're certainly a millionaire if you send this in. Mm-hmm. So that it's not just a straight word processing typing kind of thing. So you're actually using a mail merge mm-hmm. facility. That's interesting. It's very simple to see how to do a simple one, but it's not as you get more and more complicated. It looks like when you get down to your Jubilee edition, you're actually really doing a lot of original writing.
Oh, I am. I have what I think of as prompts that I get from my mail merge, and I'll sit down with their form and kind of, and because the whole thing with doing something as complicated as a Jubilee is to really understand where the couple's coming from and what they want and, you know, what's important to them. And so I read the material when it first comes in, and then I sit down with my laptop and I put little bits and pieces of it into my mail merge, and then I do a merge and I merge it into the document. And that usually contains, what am I up to? For that, it's about 15 different merge files going mm-hmm. into the document.
Wow.
Yeah, it's something only Evelyn Brown could do.
Well, I have to say, I mean, mail merge is a very common program, but I haven't heard of this extensive of use of the mail merge.
I don't know if anybody else would ever want to do something like it.
Really? Now, you know, send those cards and letters in. Oh, yeah, we use it all the time, but I have never seen.
But I have address files and inventory files, which allow you to put long descriptions of your inventory products in. And that's what I use to do my Jubilee, because it has long descriptions. And you can, you know, say, on their first date, they did this. And then when I merge it all into the document, and it has my transitions, you know, and gee, soon, you know, he was so attracted to her that he wanted to ask her out. And on their first date, they did this. So I have
those transitions, and that's where the
merge comes in. It merges right in. And then I go back and I, you know, fill it out a little bit more and proofread it and get it all ready to go. And then I, you know, print it out again and read it, make sure everything flows and that it gets the flavor that I want. Because some people you want to use, you know, garden metaphors, and some people you want to use burning metaphors. And so it just depends on what the couple have told me. Because I have people tell me crazy, crazy stuff about their relationships. About where the children were conceived and all kinds of stuff. And so, you know, you kind of go back and go, okay, now do they really want this in there? And then you print it out and bind it up and send it off to them.
So you do a little negotiation.
Yeah, and I had one fella who was telling me all about the great time they used to have when they were each married to other people, and they'd meet, and the only place they could meet was in their car. Okay? They used to meet on a residential street in their car. Okay? Do I need to say more? And he got a lot more graphic about what went on in that car. And I kind of, you know, did it euphemistically, and, you know, they really, you know, crowned their love. It wasn't even that graphic. I mean, it was just a very sweet little metaphor. And he called me up and he said, you know, the first thing that happened when I gave that book to my wife was my 10-year-old daughter picked it up. And he said, all I could think of was the stuff I told you. And he said, and when I got to that passage, he just was ecstatic. He said, you handled
thank
it
you very
so
much.
Well. Because he and his wife knew exactly what went on in that car, but the little girl would have no idea. So
no concept. And if one person says their pet name is Fluffy the cat, another person says it's Spot the dog, and the next person says I don't have any pets,
then
what do you do?
Then that's handled through options within the document. I have an option. If it's a cat, you say you use this text. If it's a dog, you use that text. And if there's no animal, and then I have people that say, well, we have a boa constrictor. And then I got to go in and rewrite the passage myself. But most of this fits. I mean, and I can even fit hamster into this dog or cat kind of route, you know, a fluffy little animal. But when you get into something that doesn't have any feet and no fur, then you got to go in and change it.
Snakes. They can't exactly jump into the room.
I even had a guy who had a donkey.
A donkey.
But after doing 5,000 of these, you hear a lot of different stories.
You know, I'm always about once a year I read a technical journal which describes about how complicated the Social Security Administration's computer systems are, and the databases are just far too complicated for anybody to understand. And I think you might be a good candidate to just break those right
down.
Well,
you know, it's just a thing of necessity is the mother of invention. It's like, okay, people wanted me to write, you know, about their wedding or about this or about that. And it's like, okay, how am I going to do this? And I did it from, you know, longhand for a long time, where I just sit down and had my form and I just write it. And then after you write them, you start getting the flavor of them. And so I have 3 or 4 basic texts with transitions and things like that. And then after I read it and I can get a feel for this couple, I know which one of those to use or what changes would need to be made. And
so you get a flavor for what's common, so you and that might change. So you can make you start to add options
right,
then.
Right.
In your largest novel, how many options switches might there be? 40?
Well, oh boy. In the Jubilee, the questionnaire is 5 pages long.
Oh my
and
goodness.
And that's this is the custom written portion. That's not even the novel that has hair and eye color and all that stuff. And there must be 20 options on a page. So I'm talking about 100 different questions.
I have to say that I see why there aren't a whole bunch of people doing this.
It's definitely a labor of love.
Oh, that's good. That's very good. If you have no other orders and you're ready to go, how long from, say, on the smallest one, the keepsake, the heroine's first and last name, from the moment you start till you get a completed bound novel, how long would that take?
If somebody had a stopwatch on me, I could do it in 10 minutes.
Yeah. Really? Now, how about when you go all the way down to the, you know, the Jubilee edition?
The actual time spent on a Jubilee, aside from when I just have it rolling around in my brain, and I'm still getting used to the Jubilee format because I've only done maybe a dozen of them.
Mm-hmm.
Takes me probably 8 to 10 hours.
8 to 10 hours.
I've got if somebody sends me a PS edition that is just answering my questions and doesn't write on the back and, you know, it's a pretty standard thing, I can do one of the epilogues in about 3 hours.
About 3 hours. How many romance novels have you published?
Individual ones. I'm working on 5,000 right now.
5,000 people.
In 5 years.
Have bought in 5 years have bought personalized romance novels. Who buys these?
Well, mostly it's men. Yeah, buying for their wives because, you know, romance novels are a real guilty pleasure and no one admits to reading them. and yet they're the most popular genre in publishing today. And so the men see their wives reading them and then hear me talking about it either on a radio station or see a magazine article or something. And they say, oh, I got to get this for Hillary or whoever. And that's the story I hear over and over is, oh, my wife waits for the new Danielle Steele novel to come out, you know. Oh, you know, I gotta kick all those dime store romance novels out of my way when I want to go lay down because she's just got them all over. I mean, women read two a day.
I really would have said, oh, come on, you know, guys don't buy personalized romance, and I can't believe. Well, the funny thing is, we had recently on our program Ira Bachrach, who's president of NameLab. He named the Acura automobile and names many things. Mm-hmm. And he's a wonderful fellow who's done many, many things. And I think we were setting up this interview when he said, who was that? He said, oh, I know her. She's got to remember me because I ordered one of those and I gave her an incredible number of details about her. He went on and on, and he was absolutely thrilled. Here is this, you know, very sophisticated, high-level businessman, deals with the presidents of international corporations on a regular basis, and he was thrilled with this. I said, well, can I mention that? He goes, oh, sure, you can mention that. He goes, she knows more about me and my wife.
I end up knowing so much about these people, it's really frightening.
Now, my husband had a question. I was going over this, and I look over these forms. I had some of the forms here. Mm-hmm. And you sign up for either a special joke between you or a secret sign. So, of course, my husband has decided, you know, he's developing secret signs now. He had one with his fingers all kind of scrunched around. What is a secret sign? What are typical secret signs?
Oh, ways that people say I love you to each other. I have people that say, you know, they scrunch up their eyes and screw up their face when they're in a crowded place that says, that means I love you.
Oh.
You know, or women, you know, they have, growing up, my parents always had, you know, if you got a call from Billy Walters, that meant my father arrived at his destination all right and he's fine, and you know, but there's no need to accept the charges on the phone call.
Uh-huh.
You know, those kinds of family, loving little things that uh-huh. happen.
My life must be barren. I have to go dig up these.
Well, the great thing is about 2 years ago, I asked my husband, I said, you know, if you had to fill out one of these forms, what would you say? What would you say for, well, I'm a redhead, so he that's really obvious. But I said, now, tell me about our first kiss. Where was our first kiss? And he said, oh, I remember it exactly. We were at the L.A. Zoo. And it's like, oh, okay. Well, we didn't go to the L.A. Zoo together until we had our first child. And she was in the stroller. I said, now, who was this that you kissed at the L.A. Zoo? That wasn't me.
Whoops.
So I think it's funny, you know, and I often wonder how often my customers get caught in something like that.
That was Evelyn Brown, president of Swan Publishing. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Distribution is handled by Larry Goldberg, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Your interview host is Dr. Moira Gunn. If you'd like a cassette tape or transcript of this broadcast, or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. For Tech Nation, this is Mike Amatori. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.